Welcome. Thank you for coming. And I want to thank Smith College for donating the space. And my, how many are we? 8 board members now? When I became president a couple of years ago, we could hardly get anybody to be on the board. So this is really phenomenal that our community is growing and being really gathering around. So there is an email list. If you are not on our email list, there's an email list to sign up for. Please print carefully so we can get the right email, or it will go out into cyberspace and get lost, which many things do. So we also ask for a $10 donation, if please, and if you can't afford that, that's all right, but we need money to help keep our organization going. And we also have an archive on our website that you can listen to past lectures. Not all of them have been recorded, but we're beginning to record them with video now. So this is really exciting. And we have a new thing happening tonight, a little book donation sale. So Chris, one of our board members, is going to talk about that.
Yeah, since our last meeting, we learned of an opportunity to buy up some books on
can you hear?
Psychology.
I can. Use the mic.
Since we met last time, there was an opportunity to buy books on Jungian psychology and from a private library. So the board agreed to buy up some books and make them available to you, people that come to the lectures, at a very, very low cost. So please, every meeting I'll bring a different selection of books. So please peruse the books and pick anything that you like. We're asking for a donation for the books. I made a suggestion for a donation. So if this suits your budget, great. If it doesn't, then do what you can. We're really eager to pass on these books, and it's inspiring, these writers and this topic, obviously, which is why we're all here. And special thanks goes to, question.
Would you like books donated to further that?
Not right at this time, thanks. Perhaps in the future. And special thanks goes to Seth Nemeroff. I'd like Seth to stand up, who spent many hours brokering this deal and going over the books and helping me pick books and making it all possible. Seth runs a book business right here on Green Street. So know about Seth and his interest in these things too. Thank you very much. Enjoy the books.
So, I need 3 hands. Our next, in January, I will be doing a introduction to alchemical symbolism, which is quite a circus. It's really fun. I wouldn't call alchemy fun. But we have a little flyer, and we really appreciate it if people out in the hill towns or people who are further out can take some flyers and put them up, because we can't get out there and let people know about them. Okay. Also, we're interested maybe in doing another book group in the spring. So if you're interested, we would really be curious what you maybe wanted to, if there was a particular book that you wanted to work with, or if you're even interested in a book group. We did MDR, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung's autobiography for 2 semesters. And we can do the Red Book, we could do Von Franz's Way of the Dream, her videos, we could do Man and His Symbols. So if you are interested in a book group, in some future, even some future time, just put your name down, well, you can just, and write a book if there's one that you're really interested in, so we can begin to figure out what we'd like to do. Okay. So just note that the introduction to alchemy is on a Sunday in January. We decided to once a year do a Sunday thing so people can come in from the cold and come have brunch or dinner and get home before dark and spend a little more time. It's a 3-hour from 1 to 4. So,
do you have the date on that yet?
That's the 10th. It's on our website, and it'll be on an email. Another very wonderful thing happening is the Boston Institute is starting a winter clinical intensive for mental health workers or students who are studying psychology or graduate students. So This is January, Friday and Saturday, the 15th and 16th. They also have a snow date. And just let me, I'll read you a couple of titles. Treating Depression, Neurological, Psychoanalytic, and Spiritual Perspectives. Passion, Obsession, and Emotional Detachment, Exploring Hidden Trauma and the Dynamic Images of the Dark Mother. Symbolic Mystery and Clinical Process in Jungian Analysis. So it's going to be a really wonderful seminar. And if you're interested, pick up one of these books. And if you're not interested, don't pick up one of these books. Because I only have about 12 of them. Okay, so the other thing is, we don't have a break. Some of you know this drill. We don't have a break. We go straight through, and if you need a bathroom, there's a bathroom right there, and anybody can use it. We make it a uni bathroom, so just use it if you need it. So, and the winter clinical intensive, you can get CEUs for it also. Let's see, tonight again we will have our salon at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street, so please come have a cup of tea with us and continue a relaxed conversation after tonight. So tonight we have Fair Green, who's we always bring in on December because people have a tendency to want to go elsewhere, and so we need somebody to draw, lots of people, and he's going to be doing on psychic transformation in the analytic process. And what can I say about Fair? I don't know.
Probably the less the better.
Fair is wonderful, wise, obstreperous. That's a favorite word of mine these days, obstreperous. Let's see, has many, many years of clinical experience and personal work. So let's welcome Fair Green.
Thank you. I'm going to talk without a mic, and if you in the back rows can't hear me, I will then use a mic. But I spent 9 years as a preacher, and I have lectured ever since, so I usually can project my voice pretty well. But if you're missing words, I'll get the mic. My title is Psychic Transformation, but I really want to introduce this talk by saying that this is the analytic process is one avenue, one method, one approach for psychic transformation. Human transformation, but there are many, many ways that our lives can be transformed. They can be transformed significantly by whom we fall in love with, certainly by the kind of parents we've had. There are all sorts of religious transformations that are significant, and the essence of transformation is a radical change, almost a turnaround in many cases. The Greek word for repentance used in the New Testament is metanoia, and it has this motif of turnaround. The ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus he had a philosophy of the tension of opposites, which is also basic to Jung's approach. And Heraclitus says is that when something becomes too one-sided, there will be an enantiodromia. In other words, it'll turn upside down, topsy-turvy, which we often experience when we're going through some kind of radical change. The Native American tradition has the medicine wheel, which if you follow its really deeply insightful meanings, is a journey towards transformation and wholeness. The whole Eastern meditative tradition, while in some ways it's different, the goal is self-realization, enlightenment. In the Japanese tradition, it's Sartori. So this is simply the way it tends to happen within the analytic process, since we're here to explore Jung's understanding of transformation. Now, I'm going to start with dictionary definitions of the words of the word transformation. To transform, quote, to change markedly the form or experience, to change the nature, function, or condition of, to change in structure and composition of, to change in nature, disposition, and heart. And the word form, to shape or form in a particular form, the contour and structure of something as distinguished from its substance, the mode in which a thing exists, acts, or manifests itself. And then the word trans means across, over, beyond, through. And we have in nature, just to give you a couple of examples, the caterpillar who goes into the chrysalis and comes out a butterfly. It's a pretty radical transformation. I haven't had a lot of butterfly transformations in my work, but in a certain sense, since the word for butterfly in Greek is psyche, I'd say maybe I have. And then one of the things that I always enjoy, both in my taste buds, but also symbolically, is the lobster, which as it grows has to shed its shell, and then it goes down in the bottom of the ocean, because it's now totally naked and vulnerable, and it waits until it has grown a bigger shell. You might say that's the transformation of the persona. But those are words and images that capture this process of change. So many of you have heard me talk about some of the dreams and examples that I'm going to be giving tonight. What I'm trying to do is to weave them all together in terms of a process. I've talked about the shadow, I've talked about dreams, I've talked about various things in talks here and in my seminars, but tonight I'm talking about a process, because the analytic process is just that. It is a situation where somebody walks in the door of the consulting room and is at a certain stage in their own life journey, and if the analysis is effective and engaging, there is going to be stages of development and change in the period of analysis. Jungian analysis is not a quick fix, believe me. If you want a quick fix, you need to go to somebody who's going to focus on adjustment and adaptation of the ego personality. Because Jung, as Freud, saw that genuine transformation of the whole personality demands attention at length and in depth to what is unconscious beneath the layer of consciousness. And one of my favorite images of that is the iceberg. 7/8 of the iceberg is below the surface of the ocean. And the Titanic did not sink on the top 1/8. It was the bottom. So we get sunk by what's down there underneath. Now, the first stage for almost all of us when we go into analytic therapy is our self-presentation, our persona. Persona is the word from Latin for what was in Greek the actor's mask, the representation of a particular role, of a particular identity, and we bring our persona into the consulting room, and the analyst hopefully fairly quickly becomes aware of what this particular individual's sense of presence is in the relational world, in the outer world. What's going on underneath the surface will be revealed over a lengthy period of time with dreams, with relational dynamics with the analyst. And one of the things I like to use as an image, it's one of the reasons in my 90th year I'm still seeing clients, and when some of my friends say, "Thayer, isn't it time to retire?" I say, "Why should I retire when I love what I'm doing and I'm getting really good at it?" my sense at some level is when a new client comes in and sits down, I'm being introduced to a mystery story. I'm a detective. I'm going to help figure out what's going on behind the scenes. And that's fun. Over a lifetime, if we are capable of it, we will present many different personas to the world in the course of our evolution and development. Because it provides a function of social adaptation and public identity. I've had quite a number of personas, and I'm sure all of you have. I was a student, then I was a combat infantryman, which was a very different persona, and not one that I chose, but the U.S. government chose it for me. Then I ended up being a college chaplain and a parish minister, and then my inner voice made me realize that what I really wanted to do was to work with individuals in depth instead of handing out aspirin tablets and band-aids for cancer of the soul. And so I went and trained for 5 years to become a Jungian analyst. And I've never looked back. I mean, that was my deepest vocation. And in a certain sense, that was the mask that most appropriately fit my sense of self. So in the early years of our adult life, and even in adolescence, we're trying on various masks, various personas, to see which one really fits us most appropriately. Now, the major psychic problem in the persona issue is a tendency for some people to identify the ego with the persona. In other words, the mask we wear, the way we present ourselves to the world, can become our only sense of identity, you know. And I'll give you some examples of that. What it leads to, especially as our life progresses, if we can't change our persona, it leads to rigidity, defensiveness, and absence of interiority, that is, outer form without inner substance, which I just described in the definitions. One analyst tells of a man who shaped his life into conformity with outer demands. And one day in imagination, he saw a man tearing a mask from his face. The mask had little claw-like hands, like clinging tentacles, which had sunk deep into the flesh. And underneath, when finally pulled away, was a shriveled thing that seemed hardly human. That's a pretty dramatic expression of what I'm describing here. If we become over-identified with a particular role, with a particular image of ourselves. One of the most moving experiences that I had in the theater years and years ago was when Anita and I went to see a program of Marceau. What's his first name?
Marcel Marceau.
Most of you may be familiar with his, what is it?
A mime.
A mime, yeah, he was a mime. And he did enormous variety of things that got laughter and all kinds of aspects of psychic representation and experience. And then his final thing that he did before he closed his performance was the mask maker. And he came out and he had this benign, he put on this benign mask of, what shall I say, complacent, middle American, let's be happy, you name it, whatever. With a sweet smile and a certain kind of unawareness. And he paraded around the stage with this mask. And then, as he had done with all his previous presentations, he would take the face off that he was miming. So he tried to take this face off, and he couldn't get it off. He couldn't get it off, and pretty soon his body was in agonized contortions, and he was sort of staggering around the stage trying to get this face off. And finally, he pulled it off, and underneath was the most empty, despairing face you could imagine. And it was the last the last image, and we all walked out of the theater in silence. That's how powerful it was. So, to me, that was one of the classic representations of an identification with a particular adaptive identity. And any of us can really get stuck in that that problem. A dream of a woman with extremely successful adaptation to demands of society and greatly respected for her efficient good works. Her dream. I am at a great assembly. A man is seated at the center, writing the names of people who enter. I see myself walking rather majestically through the crowd and proudly give my name in a loud voice, head of 57 committees. Perfect example. It's really hard not to get identified with our roles, but it's critically important if we're going to be authentic, fully human, accessible at a deep level to other human beings. Here's another example. This is a woman who came to me, a young woman, very attractive. I had worked with her mother, and her mother was a piece of work, to put it kindly. She had a very powerful animus, and a very critical one, now I was working with her daughter. I am sitting on the floor of the bedroom of an apartment 15 stories above Manhattan. Suddenly, the outermost layer of my skin hardens into a clear plastic mask with sharp aquiline features of an extremely good-looking woman and drops away from my face. I exclaim, I'm not me, and start to cry. I feel as if I now have a vacant stare where there should be a face. Remarkable description. There is a white screen in the darkened room. I now notice that projected on it is the face of a man in his 50s. His skin is drawn tightly over his cheekbones. He has a white bristling crew cut, feverish eyes, and two front fangs which protrude over his lower lip. His aspect is fierce and frightening. Although it is only two-dimensional, not three, the face projected on the screen appears alive. I realize with shock and dismay that this projected face is my true face, which until now has been concealed by my exterior attractive mask. Now, what we have is the face of a vampire. In fact, I don't believe it was her true face. I personally think it was the internalized image of her mother's life-sucking, blood-sucking, energy-sucking animus that was living inside her and drawing away her own creative individual identity and force and power in life. And I'm happy to say that the analysis really worked, and quite a few years later she came back for a few sessions, and she had gone through social work school and had been trained as a therapist and was now a therapist herself, and she was quite self-possessed, so she got rid of her vampire. But this is a powerful image of, you know, a persona which in some ways seduces one into a sense of identity, while in fact underneath that, unconsciously, there's something sucking her life power away and leaving her in a very neutralized, weakened state. And so it's a dramatic example of the power of the persona. So I'm going to stop after each stage and give you a chance to raise questions that you might have about what I've said so far. Yes.
Well, it seemed that in your example, in a way, the persona was very successful in society.
We need a persona in society. Yeah, it's. I'm not bad-mouthing persona. I'm just demonstrating first its function and then how it becomes problematic and counterproductive to our lives if we don't have a certain flexibility. Now, one of the issues that occurs to me is that extroverts tend to have an easier time with their persona because their orientation is outward toward the object world, and they instinctively from early childhood sort of learn how to wear a lot of different faces. Introverts have a much more difficult time. The more introverted, usually the more difficult. I'm always, when they come to me, they're always going through the clothes closet to find something that they can wear. Or they're out shopping, if they're beginning to develop a variety of persona adaptations, they're shopping in a clothing store for new clothes. It has that aspect to it. You want to pursue more of what your question is?
Yes, I hear you talking about the rigidity.
The rigidity.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, again, in a contrasting way, in the examples, for example, well, it's too complex, but the underlying image can be pretty frightening.
Behind the persona?
Yes. How to gain interest, you know, in such a frightening underlying image?
How to gain interest in such an underlying frightening image? Usually, we're not interested, and life hits us in the persona, and we're thrown into some kind of crisis, and then we got to deal with it. You see, I think that's really the way. If we're comfortable in our persona, we're going to tend to push it a little farther until an antiadromia occurs, and boom, we got to deal with what's underneath because now it's on top, and it has us, we don't have it. And so I think that's the dynamic that's most frequent. Andy, did you have a question there? Yeah.
The over-identification with the persona, is that the norm, do you think? Do you think most people are entrapped with that? And, you know, it's always a matter of raising consciousness to step back from it and look deeper and be more authentic?
That's a good question.
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, do most people, you know, are they identified with their persona? You know, I've never done a poll on that, and probably people would resist the poll because they would want to protect their personas.
tells us something too.
Here, my instinct tells me it makes a heck of a lot of difference what your experience as a young child was. You know, Johnny is our such and such, and Susie is our so and so. In other words, if parents assign very definite roles to children, they're going to tend to adapt those persona roles because they want to please the parents, they want to feel okay about themselves, etc. So, to the extent that the parents have some level of flexibility and fluidity in their own sense of identity and self, they probably can then provide for the young child. And I mean, we're talking about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Those years are critical. They can provide a variety of reflective images for the child. They can have an empathic mirroring to the child in different experiential areas, so that the child, you know, today I'm mad, today I'm glad, today I just don't feel good, whatever. And that process takes on various faces over that period of time. I think one of the big transitions for kids is, well, now it's preschool very often, but by kindergarten and first grade, you know, you gotta have some kind of a persona. You're going out into the world and you have to present yourself, and it begins early on. Any other question? Yes?
Could you clarify if there's a distinction between persona and ego?
Got to speak up a bit.
Could you clarify if there's a distinction between persona and ego? Or are they
There's a difference between persona and ego. If there isn't a difference, then the ego has become identified with the persona. The ego is the conscious executive agent of the personality. The persona is the role, the face we present. But the ego is, executive vice president of who I am.
It's more permanent.
What?
It's more permanent then.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it is. We change our personas. We also, over a much longer period of time, change the nature of our ego consciousness. But the ego is really the outward, at its best, it's the outward manifestation and agency of the core of our being. That's when everything is working well. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next aspect of transformation, and that is Jung's theory of types. How many of you are familiar with the Myers-Briggs type indicator? Or at least with Jung's theory of types. The important terms are extroversion, introversion. Extroversion as the word extroverso points out is the flow of psychic energy out to the object, the instinctive connection with the object world. Introversion is the flow of psychic energy into one's own subjectivity. That's very different. From one's subjectivity, you relate to the object. For the extrovert, from one's objectivity, you finally get to your subjectivity. Since we live in an extroverted culture, one of the most extroverted cultures in the world, I think, it's easier to start out being an extrovert than an introvert. And what this means is that introverted kids and adults have to develop extroverted adaptations. They have to have personas available, and they're the ones that, you know, very often feel like, I don't know what to wear, don't know what to say when somebody asks me, who are you, what, tell me about yourself. They don't know how to present themselves, whereas a comfortable extrovert, you know, it will almost come spontaneously, automatically. So that's the fundamental difference. Now, we have both attitudes in our psyche, but as Jung says, one is conscious, the other tends to be unconscious. Now, I, in the Jungian analytic community, at least quite a few years ago when I did some research, I found that 85% of Jungian analysts are introverts and only 15% are like I was back then, namely quite an extrovert. And I gave a presentation at a national meeting of Jungians under the title Extroversion Archetype and Jungian Shadow. And basically what I was saying to my fellow colleagues was 85% of you have got an extroverted shadow. It's pretty primitive, and you really don't know what you're talking about when you try to describe what's going on out there. You can delve deep inside, and you like to talk about depth. And we extroverts are made to feel like we're sort of outsiders because we don't go as deep as you introverts. And I said, I want to offer a compensatory proposal, and that is that we extroverts have breadth that you lack. And I think there's, you know, I think there's validity in that. I got a lot of reactions from 100 colleagues that were at that talk.
Yeah, cheered by the extroverts, at least.
Yes, cheers. So then, the second level of Jung's typology is thinking, which is up here, and its opposite, which is feeling, down here in the typological circle. Jung makes a circle. And then there's intuition over here and sensation over here. And I don't have time to go into all the details of that. I have to assume that most of you have some sense of it. But let's say you grow up in a family of basically academic thinking types. They tend to be up in their heads, and they're smart and they're analytic, et cetera, et cetera. And they're extroverted. And their second function is sensation, which is very practical, hands-on, by the numbers, organized, etc., etc., and very realistic. And you are a little boy who's very introverted, and your strong functions are intuition and feeling. The impact of the family typological culture on your psychology can be devastating, because you don't find a kindred spirit. There's nobody, I mean, that's their inferior unconscious side in the family, and that's where your strength is. But what are you gonna do? You wanna be loved, you wanna fit in? So you will try your darndest to be a thinking sensei extrovert. And you will develop quite naturally an inferior, a complex of inferiority. You'll be good material for Alfred Adler, who talked about the inferiority complex. And that can be therefore formative in terms of not fully evoking, the parents not calling out the uniqueness of each of their children. And their children may have quite different typologies, as the two of them do, usually. Opposites definitely attract. And there's a typology test that two Jungian analysts made that's simpler than the Myers-Briggs. It's called the Gray-Wheelwright type test. And it was given to 3,000 couples over a period of time. And what they discovered was that 90% of the couples were basically opposite types. And there's a reason for that, because each of us is essentially half of a circle consciously, and the other half is a dotted line. It's in the unconscious. So who are we going to be attracted to? Somebody whose conscious capacity completes the circle and gives us a temporary experience of wholeness, which is what the honeymoon is about. And what instinctively we feel somehow, yes, we're complete together, for a time, I might add. I am an extroverted, intuitive feeler. I married a woman who was really very introverted back then, and is an introverted sensate, and her second function, I think, is thinking. And we're both perceivers by the Myers-Briggs definition, so that's a bond. And we both have our rising sign in Libra, and that's really, I think, what's kept us together.
We have a marriage in Mars.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's another story. So many marriages, really, essentially, there's a lot of opposite typology. And that's because we're drawn towards completing this circle and making a whole. Now, after, I don't think it takes 7 years to have the itch, but after a period of time, the circle splits apart, and then our task is to fill in the dotted line, you see. And so, particularly, I'd say, by midlife, we have to develop our inferior functions, whichever they may be. I am now significantly introverted. I call her a raving extrovert. I don't think she's quite there, but Anita is so much more extroverted than she was when we married, and I can sit in a chair and just look out at the Holyoke Range for a long time and love quiet and being alone. And we come into ultimately a balance if we are willing to keep exploring the frontiers of our consciousness. Do I have any more here's an experience I had. I grew up I'm a minister's son, and both of my grandfathers were ministers, and most of my uncles were college professors, and my brother was the top student at Exeter Academy. When I went there, I saw his name written in gold, and he then went on to Amherst College before me. And again, he was this academic superstar. And so the whole environment of my developmental history was thinking. And I knew that my first function was extroverted intuition. I mean, it sometimes is kind of spooky. But I know when I did group therapy, I could pretty much tell you what everybody in the group was experiencing, except myself. It wasn't until I got to Zurich and Anita and I were both going to this wonderful woman analyst who'd been analyzed by Jung for 15 years. And she told us all kinds of stories about Jung. This guy had a real shadow. One day, she said to me, "Thayer, I get the impression that you sort of assume that you are an intuitive thinker." Now, this woman had written two very clear books, and she said, "I'm a thinker. You're not a thinker. You're a feeler." And you know, that was in some way a new possibility for me. I said, "You really think so?" And she said, "Yes, I think you're a feeler." And I said, "Wow." So I went home, and that night I had a dream. And in the dream, I was given a paint can of many colors. And I dipped my paintbrush in the paint can and then brushed it against a white wall, and the whole color spectrum came out totally differentiated. Now, color is one of the primary symbols of feeling in dreams. And I took this back to my analyst, and she said, "Well, now do you believe me?" And it was like somebody had given me the key to Fort Knox, because with so many of my family and of my good friends who were teachers and scholars and researchers and were real thinking types, and I always had the feeling, I'm really not quite like they are. And so I had this sense that I don't quite measure up. And when she gave me the gift of really honoring who I was, it was transformative. I mean, this was when I was 41 years old. And the third half of my life, I've drawn more and more on my feeling function as a therapist, as a husband, as a grandfather. It made an enormous difference. So typology is a significant aspect of transformation. When we finally sort of click in to what is fundamental, essential, instinctive in us and claim it and practice it, then we can begin to expand into the areas that are a good deal murkier. And one of the things, Anita is a sensate, and so, and she, do you have Virgo in your chart? I can't remember, no.
Somewhere
you do.
Not prominent.
And so she likes things neat and orderly and cleaned up. And I'm a typological slob. My sensation function is my weakest function. And your weakest function, you tend to disparage, you tend to dismiss, you tend to avoid it, you tend not to appreciate its value, all of those things. So it took me a long time to realize that emptying the trash was for Anita an act of love. For me, it was just a chore. And there were so many other picking up the Sunday newspapers on Monday, or at least on Tuesday before the cleaning lady came, was for her something she really appreciated. For me, it had no essential value. It was, you know, it was my most inferior function. And you tend to just not give it the honor it deserves. So think about that with whatever your inferior function is. Now the fourth function, whatever the most inferior function is the closest to the unconscious. That's the connection, primary connection with the unconscious. And it's likely to be the most connected to the shadow, because the shadow is unconscious, or it wouldn't be a shadow. When I went to Dr. Edward Edinger as my first training analyst, and I went there because in my initial interview with him, I was in a sweat within 5 minutes of sitting down in the chair, and I came away feeling, anybody that can cause that much unconscious anxiety, I really better go and find out what that's about. So, as another of my analysts said, fools walk in where angels fear to tread. So I was foolish and I went to my biggest problem. He was a introverted thinking sensate judger. Couldn't be more obvious. He was the incarnation of my shadow. And you called him Dr. Edinger at that point. Later, he became Ed. But and what I remember still is either my initial dream or one of my early dreams was I was approaching a wall that was blocking my passage. And there was a passageway to the through the right side of the wall, and it was a wall of worms. Now, if you can think of anything more sensate than a worm, please let me know. So that was what I had to go through in order to connect with this man. And I had a negative transference to him for a good 6 or 7 months, which I unloaded 2 or 3 times a week on Anita. So she would stay awake nights, and after I'd express my frustration, I'd go soundly to sleep. The thing that was interesting to me was I realized after a while that Edinger, although he was a very deeply conscious man in many ways, I had a negative transference, but I could pick up a negative countertransference. He could really not fully value my extroverted, intuitive, expansive psychology.
Brett,
yes. He was deep. I was broad. So, what I'm describing here is typology in the analytic relationship. And it's extremely important for a trained analyst, number one, to know what their own typology is, and therefore what their third and fourth functions are. And when, for me, a thinking, sensate, introvert, judger walks in the door, I better fairly soon be aware of that, because otherwise that person's going to not be able to relate to me, because I can't relate to that particular type, which is my most unconscious side. And so I usually make this overt and conscious between us after we've had some sessions, and hopefully if the person can understand it. One of the things with Edinger that I realized, I kept waiting for him to have feeling. And after maybe 7 or 8 or 9 sessions, I said, "Dr. Edinger, I don't think you like me, because when I went to Peter Lynn, who was an extrovert intuitive feeler, he used to encourage me, he used to support me, he used to kind of cheer me on in my process." And Edinger leaned forward and looked at me with his steely blue eyes and said, "Thayer, in order to be your analyst, do I have to be your cheerleader?" That's our cut to the quick, fairly rapidly. And so we had quite a relationship with each other, as you can imagine. And this is an important element in the analytic process, this issue of typology. And I've given you an example of how my Zurich analyst really was a catalyst for transformation. With Edinger, he, over the year, a couple of years I've worked with him, we broke through our negative transference, countertransference. And part of why we broke through was I came to realize, if there's going to be any feeling in this office, I've got to bring it, because he doesn't have it. And so I really brought feeling issues and feeling responses. And he could then relate to that, but he couldn't initiate it, because it was his inferior function. And so that dynamic is what goes on in friendships, in relation to one's partner, in relation to one's children, in relation to one's parents. What is it that you can bring to this relationship that the other person doesn't have accessible in order for the relationship to move and to develop? Any questions on that? Yeah.
About this inferior function, or the fourth function, have I heard somehow that this is where our greatest gifts can come from? And our, I don't know if you could say something about that.
That's a very important question you're asking.
Can you repeat the question, please? Repeat the question.
Is the fourth function where our greatest gifts can come from? The fourth function is the least ego-connected, the least accessible to the ego. So as it appears, as one experiences it, it's deeply connected to the unconscious. So it is numinous. It has a magical quality to it. There is this sense of being connected to transpersonal values through the inferior function. And so in that sense, it's very important. I'm not sure I'd say that our greatest gifts necessarily come from it. Jung's didn't have a very good feeling function, and I wouldn't say his greatest gifts in 18 volumes was his feeling function. So I'm not sure that in that sense it supplies our greatest gifts. But in terms of spirituality, in terms of magic, numinosity, surprise, because the fourth function is not something the ego calls up, it's something that happens to us, and often unexpectedly. But I, you know, your question, I'd need to sit with that for a long time to think about the people I've worked with. If it has been an undeveloped function, but is like my feeling was less valued than my thinking, but then when I got connected with it, it blossomed and flourished. It never was my inferior function. I just treated it as somewhat less valuable than thinking because of my family culture. Now, question over here somewhere? Yes.
You mentioned that we're an extroverted society. Could you give some examples of introverted societies?
Switzerland.
Switzerland, right.
Switzerland. They make great watches. They sit on trams and don't talk to each other.
I felt right at home getting on a tram. No one said, hi, how are you, or talked to me. Felt right at home.
I'm sure there are other introverted cultures, but
India.
That's the one we experienced for a couple of years. And it really has a very different feel to it than our culture.
New England.
New England, God's frozen people. Okay. Yeah.
Would you speak a little bit to the difference between the P and the J, the judging and the perceiving? Because judging is such a laden word in our culture.
That's a good point. I'm glad. Yeah. Judgers feel a little uncomfortable when they know they've got a primarily a judging function. Judgers are people who want results, who want some kind of productivity, who want clarity, who want things to come to an end and move on. Perceivers are interested in process and in evolution and development and are much less concerned with results and finality and clarity. Not that it's not available to some extent, but that's a difference between the two. Yeah.
Does personal typology shift over time, or does it tend to be durable?
That's another very good question. I think it enlarges itself is the way I describe it. I don't think I've lost my extroversion. If you can relate to me over the last 30 minutes. But I'm now in my 90th year, and I'm much more interior. That's what draws me, especially the feeling. I cry a lot these days. I didn't used to cry, but so many things bring me to tears. And they're usually tears of gratitude. At my age, just having the sun come up, looking at the natural world, enjoying my grandchildren, watching Anita sing in the choir. When she sings, she's transformed. on and on. My attitude has changed. Fortunately, I've had a heck of a good education. I've got 3 graduate degrees, et cetera, and so I'm an intuitive thinker. I'm not a thinker, but I've also got a high IQ, and that helps. So those 3 functions, I think, are all really available and accessible to me and have developed. The sensation function, if you saw my desk, you'd have seen it all. I feel overwhelmed by papers, details, stuff. And she's always wanting me to clean up my stuff. And it never gets cleaned up. And once in a while, she just comes, swoops in, and cleans it for me. She's learned that she has to consult me as she cleans it. But the 4th function, I don't think ever becomes very conscious. You just have, what shall I say, a diplomatic relationship with it. Yeah.
Is it true that the 4th function, if you're an extrovert, it's going to be along the sensate, intuitive lines, and if you're an introvert, that it's likely to be along?
No.
Okay.
They are all equally available depending on your constitution when you're born. And this is not something that's a product of the developmental process.
No, I'm talking about it being the 4th one.
Oh, the 4th one.
That you identify the 4th one as, if you're an extrovert, it's going to be the one that you aren't on the sensory intuitive line, and if you're an introvert, it's on the thinking feeling line. So like being an extrovert, then your sensate function, it's going to be the intuitive or the sensate function, and because you're an intuitive, it's your sensate function that is your 4th function. If you are, if you were an introvert, then we might be looking at the thinking feeling line, and whichever you aren't, so thinking would be your 4th function. That's something that I've learned before. I don't know.
Uh-huh. I'm not sure I know how to answer that question.
Okay.
I think all of the attitudes, I mean, feeling, thinking, intuition, sensations, are available to both all introverts and all extroverts.
Yeah, all of these are available. It's a question of to what extent we have access to them from the ego conscious position. Okay, I want to move on to the next stage of transformation, which is the shadow. The shadow stands in tension with the persona because it doesn't fit our persona adaptation, especially as we develop and emerge. I mean, later on, we hopefully assimilate more and more shadow so that our ego relationship to ourselves and the world becomes more balanced, more complete. Whatever was in our shadow becomes more and more assimilated by the ego in this process of transformation. The more rigid and extreme the ego persona identification, and I'm talking here about the extent to which the ego has become blended and identified with the persona, so it's not a separate, autonomous, flexible ego, but it's a persona ego. The more rigid and extreme the ego persona identification, the more extreme and darker will be the shadow side of the personality. I mean, if the ego is really identified with a persona, then the shadow is going to be more extreme. And my analyst, Whitmott, Edward Whitmott, puts it in one brief phrase: the shinier the face, the smellier the feet. The more extreme the way we present ourselves and are identified with that, the more split off we are from our own dark side. Now, Jung says, describes the shadow, the thing that the person has no wish to be. And I think that's a pretty good brief description. The shadow is a universal phenomenon. It is, in that sense, archetypal. If we do not cast a shadow, or if we did not cast a shadow, we would be insubstantial. The contents of the shadow are powerful, marked by affect, obsessional energy, possessiveness, autonomous energy. It has a life of its own. And it's capable of overwhelming a well-ordered ego. And usually we first experience our shadow in projection. Yeah, I can't stand that guy. He's creepy, or whatever negative projective phenomenon we experience with somebody, the more affect there is in it, the more you're looking at your shadow. And that's a kind of a basic rule of experience, that the way we first meet our shadow is usually in projections. We then meet our shadow in dreams, thank God, because the unconscious then gives us the beginning of understanding and access. Jung has an interesting thing to say about the shadow and our desire to eliminate it. He says, mere suppression of the shadow is as little of a remedy as beheading would be for a headache. I think that's a pretty dramatic description. And the persona shadow dynamic, interactive tension of opposites is a good bad polarity, perfection versus inclusion. And we have many examples of that in literature. Probably one of the most dramatic is Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was, you know, the original movie was just wonderful. Joseph Conrad, if you read his books, The Secret Sharer, that's a story of a shadow figure that gets onto a sailboat and is with the captain, and I can't go into the details, but it's a positive tale of how this shadow is accepted by the captain of the ship in a way in which he guides the ship away from the rocks that the ship would otherwise land on. And that's a pretty good description of psychology. The shadow, really, we're liable to crash on the rocks, if we don't listen to our shadow. He also wrote Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad, and that's a darker description of shadow by far. Then there's Jung's adolescent, I think he was 12 to 14, adolescent vision that he had one day growing up in Basel, and he had this autonomous vision of God Almighty in the heavens dropping an enormous turd on the Basel Cathedral. Those of you who have read his autobiography, he describes it. And it blasts open the cathedral. And he had such a hard time allowing himself to fully see and experience this vision. Finally, he had the courage to allow it to be fully present. And it then was the beginning and the origin of his understanding of the dark side of God, and of which the Bible has many examples. Then there's in Egyptian mythology, there's the tension between Osiris and Set. If you're familiar with Set, is the dark shadow side. And then, of course, Christ and Satan. I did my doctoral dissertation on Satan and Psyche, and it was a study of the ego's encounter with the experience or the perception and experience of evil. I think it was probably rooted in my Puritan ancestry, but also in my experience of liberating that concentration camp when I was in the war. Then I'll give you a dream that I had, and this was 10 years anyway after I had become a Jungian analyst, somewhere around there. I had driven home from analytic work in the city, and this is in the dream, and my car, you know, I just pushed the button and the garage door had gone up, and it was dusk, so my lights were on, and there standing at the entrance door to my home was a black teenager with a open switchblade in his hand. And it was clear that I was not going to be able to get home until I had dealt with this black teenager. And I don't think this, frankly, was a racist dream. It had quite a different meaning. So I took the dream to Whitmont, who was then a colleague, but he still occasionally served as my analyst. And he had me do this. He said, "Thayer, I want you to relax, see if you can put yourself in a light trance, and then I want you to dematerialize as Thayer and rematerialize as this black teenager. I want you to get inside that image and be that teenager." And so I spent some time and I said, "Okay, I'm right there with the switchblade." He said, "Now tell me, what's your life like?" And I described living on the streets, didn't know who my father was. My mother was addicted to drugs. I was out to survive. I pushed drugs. And if anybody fuck with me, they were going to get cut up. And it was more pretty colorful. And he said, how would you describe that? I said, I am ruthless. I'm ruthless. I don't give a shit. Well, I was famous in the New York Jungian community as this tender-hearted, nourishing, supportive, good guy. And so here, finally, I had met one aspect of my shadow. And the critical word was ruthless. And even in the war, in combat, it was very hard for me to be a killer. So here I am all these years later sharing that dream, and it had a real impact on the way I work with clients, on the way I related to my teenage children, at times the way Anita and I related to each other. She has less difficulty with this than I do. It was something I needed deeply, because it wasn't part of my developmental history or my training. I needed to be not nice. And one of the wonderful graphic descriptions of beginning to absorb one's shadow is to spit saliva into a glass until you got about that much saliva, and then drink it. I had one of my first clients when I was in training, when I was at Union Seminary getting a graduate degree in psychiatry and religion, was a seminary student who came to me for a very reasonable fee, which is what you charge back then if you were in training. And I think I saw him, and I got a little of his presenting symptoms, but then he came in the second section. I said, have you had a dream? And he held up this piece of paper, like very soiled toilet paper, and handed it to me. And I looked at it, and what was written on it was, I am orally masturbating myself. Now, number one, you've got to be pretty flexible to do that, I'd say. And he was disgusted. You could see the amount of disgust and shame that was connected with this image. Well, it so happened that the night before I had this dream presented to me, I was in a seminar with Dr. Edinger, and he told us about a Hindu myth of Vishnu who orally sucked on his penis, had an ejaculation into his mouth, and then blew out his semen and created the world. Yeah. And so, being therefore a well-informed, mythologically trained analyst, the next day I had this dream. You want to see Jung's synchronicity working? That's a perfect example. And so, to me, the dream was pretty obvious. And I told him the myth, because I knew if he had that archetypal background, he could then understand this in a symbolic rather than a deeply personal physical way. And he was very confused about his sexual identity. And I said, this dream suggests first that you need to inseminate yourself. You need to be creatively inseminated by an introverted process of self-discovery. And then as that happens, you can go out into the world and be creative. And, you know, it fits the myth very clearly. So I got good grades for that. William Blake has a wonderful quote around the shadow. Form comes from heaven, but energy from hell. And we need both. We need energy and form. Shadow is a repressed energetic source. Jung writes, energy is itself neither good or bad, neither useful or harmful, but neutral, since everything depends on the form into which energy passes. Form gives energy its quality. For the creation of a real value, therefore, both energy and valuable form are needed. And I remember one man I work with who had a constricted quality to his whole psychology. And, you know, in the course of my work, I mean, there were times my impulse was just to shake him, see if I could get him to be more energized. But I didn't, and I played therapist. And he had a dream after a while. I could see things were beginning to move, and he had a dream that his whole house was being rewired with a more powerful level of energy. I've told most of you at one time or another my famous active imagination of the ape after I had murderous rage, and I invited an active imagination. This ape appeared. I'm not going to go into that because I see I need to get moving. When I did a picture of the ape, my analyst held up the picture, and I put myself right next to the ape, and she said, "Thayer, do you see how you've drawn the ape, and then how you've drawn yourself?" And the ape was big and brown and full of energy, and I'd drawn Caspar Milquetoast there next to it, sort of a bland image of myself. And she said the most wonderful thing. She leaned forward and she said, "Thayer, speaking as a woman, I prefer the ape." Some of you have heard that, but that was transformative. This beard, which used to be brown and full, was my way of honoring the ape. To fail to acknowledge and relate to personal shadow leads to identification with collective righteousness and ignoring... What am I saying here? Collective righteousness and identifying with the collective shadow. So I guess what... And what I remember, among other things, was when I participated in the liberation of this concentration camp in Nordhausen, Germany, where there were corpses and dying, starving people looking at you with eyes straight out of hell. We got local townspeople, because this camp was right on the edge of town, and we lined them up and we marched them through that camp so they saw what they had refused to see all the time it had been there. And they were confronted with their collective shadow that they had allowed themselves to be identified with. And you know, there are other examples of that. Another one that I will share is back in 1964, when LBJ took over the White House and initiated the Civil Rights Act, and it was being fought over in Congress intensely, as many of you will remember. One of the ways that there was a witness to what was going on was that there was a clergy vigil at the Lincoln Memorial 24/7 for the 6 weeks or more that the Civil Rights Act was being fought over in Congress. And I was at Union Seminary getting this degree, and they asked for volunteers to go down and stand vigil. So I went down a couple of times and spent a couple of days, and you were 4 hours on and 8 hours off and 4 hours on. And my first 4 hours was from midnight to 4 a.m. in front of the Lincoln Memorial. It was a pretty powerful experience for me. And I then went back to my hotel, and I had a dream. And in the dream, I was standing with a crowd in front of an institution that looked like an educational university type institution. And Governor Wallace was standing in the doorway. Now, most of you are old enough, remember that Governor Wallace did stand in the doorway preventing integration in the University of Alabama. And I then handed Governor Wallace a rifle, and he started shooting at me. Well, I took this dream back to Dr. Edinger, who was not the sentimental, sensitive type, thank God. And he said, "Thayer, this is a very illuminating dream." He said, "You went down there for all kinds of good collective social justice reasons, and I have no argument with your motivation to go down there. But what I see so often in passionate social liberals is an unresolved shadow problem." And he said, "That's what this dream is about. You have a Governor Wallace segregationist in your own unconscious, and you're arming that segregationist as you go down there to fight for desegregation. That's a paradox, isn't it?" So that was shadow. That was a shadow problem. And he nailed it. Any questions on shadow? Yeah.
So in that last example where the governor, I assume you're projecting yourself.
Speak up.
So the last example where your shadow was the governor shooting at you, once you acknowledge that, what do you do with that?
Can you repeat the question?
The question was, how do you acknowledge the dream I just described after my great social action activity, which can make one feel quite righteous, I might add. Well, my analyst nailed so clearly the issue that I then had to really begin to explore, how am I segregated from my own shadow. And if you remember the switchblade black teenager, that came well after this dream. So I continued to be a segregationist for quite a while. Okay, I want to go on to the next stage. Plato's character Aristophanes tells of an ancient Greek myth about the original human beings who were perfectly round, had four arms and four legs, with two faces looking opposite directions. The gods were envious of these powerful humans and split them apart into two halves, one masculine, one feminine, and ever since, these two parts have been striving to reunite. That's a pretty good description of the pull of the animus and the anima, wanting to reconnect. As I think I said earlier, the Gray Wheelwright research with 3,000 couples, the task of every man who wants to be whole and discover and establish a conscious relationship to his inner feminine. That's the task. The woman, likewise, for the woman, it is just the reverse. That is a conscious relation to the inner masculine, the man within. And Jung writes about the conjunctio, which is the inner marriage of the masculine and the feminine within each of us, where we have access to both dimensions, the yang and the yin, for example, and in the Tai Chi, the way they keep revolving and changing. I give you an example from my 64 and a half years of absolutely deliriously happy marriage. And this is my reaction to Anita on an occasion where I remember we had a real spat in the kitchen in our home in Westchester, and she could be pretty bitchy and cutting, and I felt so hurt that I went down to my office and sat, I think, in the dark, and this voice began to emerge within me and say, "Thayer, she really doesn't understand you, and no wonder you're down here feeling so upset, and you just have to realize that there's an aspect of yourself that is so vulnerable and so important that she just doesn't have a clue, etc." This was the voice of the seductress, the seductive anima, you know, the vampirish anima. And this went on for 10, 15, 20 minutes of real sulking. And then finally, another voice spoke and said, "Thayer, are you really getting what you need listening to this seductive voice down here? Or would you have more real fun and relatedness if you went upstairs to the kitchen and dealt with a real live woman?" And I decided that voice had precedence. So I went upstairs to the kitchen, and within 3 or 4 minutes, we were back connected with each other. And I think, you know, that's what men need to deal with in terms of their anima. Now, I hesitate to describe the animus issue for with a woman, but I'm going to. Which is, an animus possessed woman is like a stormtrooper, and the worst victim is their own interior feminine nature, because it becomes a controlling guardian of the little girl, and it's got a sword in its hand, and it intimidates the adult or the little girl that's been somehow taken over by this masculine energy, and it makes no sense for a man to argue with this guy with a sword in his hand. You're not going to get anywhere. The only possible way you can break through this is to say, don't argue, don't be logical. The animus can be quite illogical. Say, what are you feeling? You must be hurting somewhere. I mean, I want to connect with you, etc., etc. Some kind of an empathic feeling response will get to the little girl, and she'll suddenly become a woman with a chance to speak her side of whatever the relational dynamic is. And it works. It's just as Anita will let me do my sulk and then wait for me to come out of my sulk and re-relate to her.
Sometimes I went down and got you.
Yes, that's true.
Moving on.
You know, I... I'm not going to go any farther. The ultimate goal is to have a connection between a conscious ego and the core of our being, what Jung calls the self. And the anima and the animus are the really final bridges that you have to cross in order to connect with our true natures. And this is a process of a lifetime. You know, I still occasionally have a dream that guides me. Or I have an analyst over the breakfast table. So that's a great help. So, reactions, questions.
I got one.
Yes.
If nothing else, you are a power of example as to why it might be worth living to 90.
What?
I think you're an example of why it might be worth living till 90.
You know, I've outlived all of my ancestors except my great-great-great-grandfather, who was called to be the first minister of the parish church in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, and he was the pastor of the church for 76 years. He died at the age of 101. So that's kind of my goal. I mean, it's amazing. Here I am. But frankly, what I'm doing right now with your responsiveness is part of what keeps me alive. Just as my work as an analyst is a renewing experience on a daily basis. So, I thank you for your attention.
Are you going to do anything with the dreams?
What?
With the dreams you had already for us?
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank you. I've got to go over these dreams were my culmination.
You have 5 or 10 minutes at the most.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I work with a client while I was at Union Seminary in my training that whose dreams were the most amazing dreams, Dr. Edinger at that point was my supervisor, and he, you know, I reported these dreams and gave him copies. He said, Thayer, I've worked with analysts who've been practicing for 30 years and they never had a set of dreams like this, which is why I saved them. Now, these dreams came after 2 months, 2 years, one before I went to Zurich and one after I came back from Zurich.
Are they your dreams?
These are not my dreams. These are dreams. The following is a series of dreams over a period of 3 months. The dreamer was a clergyman who had failed to be effective in his ministry of a pastorate and had ended up in a menial clerical job in a research library for a national magazine. He worked in the research library for Time magazine. And this guy was disembodied. He was interested in Asian spiritual meditation a bit, but there was this enormous constriction in him. So he then, and finally in this period, after 2 years of analytic work pretty much, I was in a church, and of course that's what he had to leave because he was so ineffective. My brother stood beside me on my left. I was being married to him. I had a Bible. I gave the Bible to him, but kept only the binding. You know, the persona and the substance right there. I was descending with my brother towards the center of a cone. I heard a voice say that my brother was condemned. When my brother got to the center, devils with horns and tails appeared on the scene. They grabbed my brother and pushed him into a circular bellow that resembled a dragon. Someone asked whether my brother had his last rite. Dr. K, who seemed to be in charge of the whole devilish operation, said that he already had his last rite and could and should be immediately pushed into hell. I noticed my brother's face in the long circular bellow, and he had a smile. Now, Dr. K was this patient of mine's spiritual mentor and had been central to his theological education. And Dr. K was rigidly spiritual and up here in the sky, and a very patriarchal influence. And so that was the first of this series of dreams. 3 days after the previous dream, he dreamt the following. I was looking into a deep pit. I was going into a deeper level than the average person does. I was going to go down this dark shaft to the level where there is no God. So 3 days after his brother went down, and his brother was earthy, instinctual, practical, not terribly spiritual, was his shadow. And so first the shadow goes down under condemnation, but then, thank heavens, 3 days later, he descends to that level where there was no God. Now, what's really being said, where the God he'd been worshiping couldn't get to. Then 1 month later, the descent into the level where there is no God brought the man to this dream. I was in a large church. There was no altar. I sat in a pew. Soon everyone in the church stood up. I noticed on my left a young person with no clerical garb on him except a golden chain around his neck and hung in front of him. I knew he had some authority, but not ecclesiastical authority. So this is a whole new religious presence. Shortly he said, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I thought it meant praise be to the Lord Krishna. The congregation responded with the same words three times. Then we all knelt with our faces touching the floor. The fellow on my right made sure I was doing what the others were doing because I felt his body pressing against my shoulders. He associated that fellow with me, his therapist. I felt like I was going through some form of initiation. Then I was in front of the church, standing where the altar usually stands, and I was facing the congregation. On my left appeared a muscular male with only a cloth around his loins. He stood in a position resembling the Indian temple dancers. He was on one foot and began to whirl faster and faster. This reminded me of the Old Testament prophets who used to go into a frenzy in order to hear the word of the Lord Yahweh. Immediately I turned to my left and noticed a large image of Buddha. As the man danced, the image of Buddha began to change. Red, yellow, blue, green. Remember my paintbrush. Here, feeling is suddenly emerging in this man. And it appeared as if Buddha was coming alive. I felt again the numinous power in the church. After this performance, and I'm also thinking of the whirling dervishes in this part. After this performance, a male and female appeared from the left. They also had only a small cloth around their loins. The male laid on the floor and the girl on top of him. She began to rub her nose against his with an intense rhythm and a definite beat to it. I couldn't understand what it all meant. I hope nobody in this audience doesn't understand. I had some suspicion they were having sex or portraying the power of sex. I hoped this male would not get an erection, as it would be embarrassing, particularly in a church situation, you know, that he wouldn't need Viagra. The wonderful thing here is that the erotic, the sexual, the energy, the feeling is all happening in a church. Granted, it's not exactly Christian, but it's what the Christian church desperately needs most of the time. 2 weeks later, the man dreamt, "It was night. I was walking along the street and came by a small newsstand. The newsstand owner was not well, so a bright youth was looking after the newsstand. I asked the boy who he was, and he replied, 'I am Ramakrishna.' I bowed in reverence. He said, 'You don't have to be embarrassed by bowing down to me.' I thought to myself how strange it was for God to take the form of a newspaper boy." And in the article that these dreams come from, I talk about how the newsboy is giving the present news experience, living in the present moment, you see, is the sense of being alive in the moment, which the previous dream brings. So then, a week after the goddess newsboy dream, he reported a major dream. And this was, in a sense, the dream that shows the transformation that had taken place in the whole process. And it was not too long after this that he ended his analysis. A week after the goddess newsboy dream, he reported another major dream. "I was in my hometown church. Dr. K was preaching to about three people in the pews." Well, when he'd been preaching earlier in his ministry, there were about three people in the pews because he was spouting Dr. K. I wondered why the service was so poorly attended. Soon, Mr. G, imagine who that is, the sexton, announced that I was going to deliver the New Year's message. I had my sermon notes, and my text was, "Remember the Lord your Creator this day." Remember the newsboy. I went up to the front of the church and stood behind the pulpit. There was a white sheet over the pulpit, as if it wasn't used for a long, long time. He'd been out of the ministry for maybe 5 years. I noticed Dr. K sitting in the front pew just below the pulpit. I began to preach. I heard Dr. K remark, "His voice is not loud enough." And after my first point, I heard him say, "Why doesn't he move on to his second point?" The patriarch doesn't die easily. The essence of my sermon was that we must become aware of God's presence and participate in his creative act now. The means and the end are one. There is no duality except that which is created by the mind. I looked at my sermon notes and found that page 2 and 3 were missing. This is the nightmare of every preacher, I might add. The other notes were in a language that I wasn't able to read. So I began to draw from my inner resources and let go of the notes. I noticed more and more people were coming into the service. The church was being filled. I felt I was communicating to them. I no longer needed the notes, as I could speak from my own raw experiences. You want an example of transformation? Now I need to tell you the epilogue to that. Within, I don't know, a few months, he went back in the ministry. He was Canadian. He went back in the ministry and he ended up in a parish way out on the west coast of Canada, up in the north. Calgary, I don't know what place it was. And I used to get postcards from him every year, Christmas I think it was, telling me that he was having a wonderful time and he'd started a young study group there. And then 40 years later or thereabouts, I was at a conference with Anita out in California. And one of my colleagues, who was an analyst down in San Diego, I think, whom I knew somewhat from many conferences, she came up to me and she said, "Thayer, I've got to tell you an experience." She said, "I got a call from a parish way up in northern Canada on the west coast, asking me to come up and meet with their young study group and spend a weekend with them." And she said, so I was intrigued by this, so I agreed. And I went up there and met with this group. And what they told me was that their minister had died. His wife was still there. And they said he came to us because of a Jungian analyst named Green at Union Theological Seminary, and he transformed this parish.
Wow.
End of the story.
Please let us put the fire up for us. See you next week.